violent clashes over Jerusalem's Temple Mount have alarmed the Arab world, Japan, Europe, and the United States, and made a mockery of the peace process. Garner Ted Armstrong puts it in prophetic perspective with this audio presentation, Middle East Peace Shattered.
Is a major war about to break out in the Middle East? And if it does, will it involve some of the major Arab powers such as Syria, Saudi Arabia, and or Egypt? And if a war should break out in the Middle East, will it involve Europe and the United States? And does Bible prophecy have anything to say about it? You and I both know that the Bible is a Middle Eastern book. We know that Jesus Christ of Nazareth delivered his famous Olivet prophecy from right across on the Mount of Olives, across the brook Kidron, which is just a dry valley today, overlooking what then was a far more fabulous skyline of the city of Jerusalem than today. But today it's certainly one of the most famous skylines in all the world. So many American evangelists and religionists have gone over to Israel, and I have to confess, I too have been there. I have done radio and television programs from the Mount of Olives, from the streets of Jerusalem, back in 1966, before the 67 Six-Day War. I've done programs overlooking Golgotha, from the Garden Tomb. I've done an on-the-spot radio program a couple of times from inside the Garden Tomb, from whence Jesus Christ was resurrected. Jesus Christ of Nazareth is the greatest prophet who ever lived. One-third of the Bible is prophecy, and prophecies have mostly not been fulfilled yet. There are many prophecies that have been fulfilled. For example, dozens of them in the Old Testament that predicted the first coming of Jesus Christ as the Messiah. There are many prophecies that had to do with the collapse of ancient Babylon, of Persia, of Greece, and Rome that have been fulfilled. But some of those are dual, that's D-U-A-L, meaning having a double meaning, an earlier typical fulfillment and a latter day end time fulfillment. When in your news, Jerusalem and Israel leap into prominence once again because of violence right on the Temple Mount, and when it appears that war could get started in the Middle East, let me tell you, it's far more than just something that is curious to people who believe in the Bible. It's far more important than people who believe in biblical prophecy and have various scenarios becoming a little alert and wondering what's going to happen next. Will a temple be built? Will the abomination of desolation be set up? I wonder about those things, and that's what I want to talk to you about. But it's far more important to the Western world, to Europe, and even to Japan, than any of those spiritual, biblical, and prophetical considerations. Do you know that Japan is 70% dependent upon Middle Eastern oil for its very national survival? Do you know that Europe is 46% dependent upon Middle Eastern oil to survive? The entirety of Europe. I'm talking now about the Benelux countries, or that is Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg, the lowlands. I'm talking about powerful Germany, the most powerful nation in Central Europe. I'm talking about France, about Italy, about all those powerful countries that make up the European Economic Community, and they depend up to 46% on Middle Eastern oil for the firing of their factories and the turning of their machinery and the running of their trains and their automobiles and buses and their aircraft. The United States, 17% dependent. But the United States is about 50% dependent upon foreign oil, but because we buy oil from Nigeria, from Mexico, from other nations, as well as the Persian Gulf, we're not quite that dependent yet upon Persian Gulf oil. But the predictions are that by 2015, we will be far more than 50% dependent upon Persian Gulf oil alone at the present voracious devouring of those non-renewable resources. Now, only a few weeks ago, you and I were treated to a shocking announcement that renewed violence had broken out in Israel. But we should have expected it, because long before that time, as the article in the current number of 20th Century Watch tells you, there was a bomb blast over in Dahran at the United States Air Force barracks that blew out the front of that barracks and killed many Americans and injured hundreds. And, of course, that was an attempt by Shiite Islamic fundamentalists inside Saudi Arabia to pry loose the American presence from Saudi Arabia. They resent Western culture. They resent, as Islamic fundamentalists, the Christian religion. but they resent our ways. They resent the ways of Americans, and especially their women. They, of course, absolutely proscribe alcohol. They do not like Americans, on American bases, drinking alcohol. They don't believe in our policies of divorce. They don't believe in our way of life, in Western culture, art, language, literature, music, Western dress. They want to impose those full-length skirts with even veils with just the eye showing on their women. They want to go back into the medieval time that we know is being imposed upon women in Iran and to some extent in Iraq and in Saudi Arabia and some of those other nations, and they want the United States out of there. Now, these Shiite fanatics know that that did succeed in Lebanon many years ago, when the United States Marines were so vulnerable by being in that high-rise barracks building right next to the airport, and here so many of them were killed in that huge bomb blast, and America tucked its tail between its legs and got out of Lebanon. So these fundamentalist fanatics, these Islamic fanatics, mostly Shiite Muslims in Saudi Arabia, wanted to accomplish the very same thing. But they did so mostly following the elections in Israel, when Benjamin Netanyahu defeated Shimon Peres, who succeeded the slain Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was a personal friend of mine, whom I have interviewed several times. I have shared the podium with him at Ambassador College years ago. He has been in my office. We have eaten together. I have been in his office. I felt horrible and shocked and sickened when I saw that the poor man had been shot in the back by an Israeli fanatic who resented the peace process, the process that Yitzhak Rabin had started. Who knows whether it would have succeeded or not, but it was a process of trading land for peace. He was putting on the table the following. He was going to gradually, incrementally, grant Palestinian autonomy and eventually the creation of a Palestinian state. Of course, it was going to be slow. It was going to be a little bit and a little bit more. He armed, he allowed them to be armed, 30,000 of them, Palestinian police, with Israeli semi-automatic weapons. He gave autonomy to Jericho and also to the Gaza Strip, allowing the Palestinian police to take care of that area and to withdraw Israeli armed forces from it. But he was not going to give up on Jerusalem. He did not want Jerusalem to be a divided city. He was talking about eventually withdrawing from Hebron. That is a very great issue over there right now. And he was even talking about dealing with Assad of Syria in giving back the Golan Heights. When he was assassinated, Shimon Peres continued the same process. Remember the Oslo Accords? Remember the visits to Washington? Remember the shaking of hands between the Israeli leadership and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat? Well, that government was going to continue the policies of Yitzhak Rabin. But with the fiery, inflammatory rhetoric of Benjamin Netanyahu, there was a narrow victory. And when that occurred, Israel took a screeching turn to the right in its foreign policy and its internal politics. And suddenly Netanyahu said he would never grant Palestinian autonomy. Suddenly he said he would never withdraw from Hebron, or at least not until some sort of security arrangement were worked out. He was not going to continue to dismantle the settlements, but would continue to develop settlements. He was not going to give back the Golan Heights. That was not negotiable. He would never allow for the old city of Jerusalem to become the capital city of a Palestinian state. The bomb blast went off in Saudi Arabia, because those people look upon the United States as a mentor, protector, and provider of Israel. They know that there are more Jews in the United States than there are in Israel, in New York, and many other cities, in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills. They know that there are thousands and thousands of Jewish people in United States commerce, business, industry, in art, in entertainment. They know that the United States is a mentor, protector of Israel. And they want to pry loose American interests, American hegemony, American control, the way they look at it, of those Arab states and of Israel itself. And so the terrorist bomb went off in Saudi Arabia. Then, little by little, there were terrorist acts all over Israel. From the border with southern Lebanon, where Israeli troops and Air Force units were once again bombing suspected guerrilla hideouts, to the blasting of buses and the machine gunning of helpless civilians inside passenger automobiles, to the pipe bombings in a crowded Tel Aviv shopping center, to suicide bombers who would walk in amongst a number of Israeli civilians with pipe bombs strapped around their middle, beneath their blouse, their loose clothing, blow themselves to bits, and kill a lot of Israelis in the doing of it. Well, we were treated to all of that macabre, horrible bloodletting in the Middle East. And, of course, the Israelis are going to react. So, when that tunnel was opened recently, you already know about that, the 2,000-year-old tunnel. It has been there for about 2,000 years. It opens directly to the left as you face the huge, big Dome of the Rock at the foot of the Wailing Wall, if you've ever been there. And it opens right to the left, and it goes down, 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 right to some of the bedrock and the foundational stones that formed a part of the outer wall of the temple during the Herodian period. But it goes right straight along the parapet, or the big raised platform that forms the deck upon which the Dome of the Rock sits. It does not go closer to it. It parallels it and then veers away from it a little, and it comes up in the middle of the old city of Jerusalem. Netanyahu's government decided to open that end of the tunnel. The tunnel had been opened. It could be accessed from the other end inside the old city anyway. It was excavated long before. This was merely the opening of one of the entries, so you could enter at one end, go through it, and come out the other. The Israeli government, though, had opened up the tunnel in the dead of night, which was probably not wise, and was certainly called by Yasser Arafat a direct provocation. To the Palestinians, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. But the Israeli government was quick to point out the tourists that are going to be flocking in there, thousands of Europeans, Americans, people from all over the world, would enter that tunnel by the Wailing Wall and come out right in the middle of the old city. And as they wandered around the winding streets of the old city, there would be dozens and hundreds of shops selling everything from jewelry to rugs to fabrics and clothing and to artifacts of brass and so on. So they pointed out it would actually be a very great benefit and blessing for the old city, for the Palestinians, if they could do that. But instead it resulted in tremendous violence, and that violence threatened to spill over, and all of the Arab states became immediately, very frenetically and angrily involved. Now, you know, there were some hasty summits. There was a pre-summit meeting that I've covered in the current issue of 20th Century Watch. If you don't have that, be sure to write for it or to call for it, because it explains all of that. There was a hasty pre-summit meeting on the part of Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who was standing in for King Fahd, who was ill at the time. Abdullah went up to see Assad in Damascus. Mubarak of Egypt joined them, which was absolutely unprecedented and something that really sent up some red flags in the Pentagon and the White House, because it looked like this was cranking up the old United Arab Republic that had been defunct since the late 1950s or the early 1960s. Here were the three major powers, the three major players in the Middle East, getting together in a hastily called summit in Damascus. Mubarak of Egypt, Abdullah, who was standing in for sick King Fahd, and Abdullah is one of the royal princes of the Saudi royal family, getting together with Syrian President Hafez Assad. They put together a communique. The communique essentially dealt with the points that I've just brought up. They called upon Israel to withdraw from Hebron, to cease immediately the development of any further settlements. They called upon Israel to give back the Golan Heights. They called upon Israel to create a separate Palestinian state. And they called upon Israel to allow the old city of Jerusalem to become the capital of that Palestinian state. Then came that hasty summit that was called immediately in the wake of the Saudi Arabian bombing down at Sharm el-Sheikh, if you remember, on the Sinai Peninsula. President Clinton went all the way down there to appear with all the Arab leaders. He didn't really have a choice because of American interest in the Gulf, because America is trying to keep all of those Arab countries happy and at the same time keep Israel happy. Then came the Cairo summit. And at the Cairo summit, attended by all these Arab leaders, including Muammar Gaddafi, who thumbed his nose at UN no-fly restrictions from his base over in Libya. The communique that was adopted as a result of that summit was largely written by Hafez Assad. Hardly a word of it was changed, they said. And, of course, it called upon Israel to return to the peace process. Now, what did that really mean? It really meant to Benjamin Netanyahu and the new right-wing coalition government in Israel that they ought to adopt the very policies of the government they had just replaced. Now, think about that for a minute. In American elections, if a Republican were to win, it would be like the entire world ganging up on the Republican president and saying, no, we want you to return to the policies of your Democratic predecessor, or vice versa. So here was all of Europe for the very first time, and chillingly, for the very first time, Germany had something to say about it. And that is unique. That's new. Europe is involved. 46% dependence, remember, upon Middle Eastern oil. It is in the interests of the entire world that the Middle East at least achieve some kind of a peaceful settlement. The last place in the world the big powers, that includes Japan, Europe, the United States, and everybody else, so far as that's concerned, want a war to break out is in the Middle East, where it would widen, where other nations would get into the act. Now, I remind you that during the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein tried to do exactly that. He knew that there was a very weak coalition that was put together with baling wire and chewing gum by George Bush. And he knew that there were even increments of Egyptian armed forces inside Saudi Arabia, carefully kept to the rear, of course, because they didn't want Arabs killing Arabs, with the exception that the United States Armed Forces allowed some of the Kuwaitis to ride triumphantly into Kuwait City when the United States had liberated it, and in that case, and in the case also of some Saudi Arabian F-16 fighter bombers and Saudi Arabian forces were in direct conflict with and fighting with and exchanging artillery and gunshots with the Iraqi forces. But with those two exceptions, the other members of some of the Arab states that joined that very weak coalition were not involved at all. So it's obvious what Saddam Hussein was trying to do when he launched a Scud attack upon Tel Aviv neighborhoods. He wanted to get Israel to retaliate. He thought he could ride it out. It was a calculated risk. He didn't really think, if he went ahead and used conventional Scud warheads, that Israel would dare retaliate with nuclear weapons, which Israel possesses. Maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong. But because that red hot phone was ringing off the wall between the Israeli government and the White House, and because George Bush kept them out of it by sending Patriot batteries over there, it was a very narrow thing. The war did not widen, and it's the famous 100-hour war. It's the famous war that ended so very shortly that in retrospect, many people really feel the United States lost, that we didn't really gain anything because Saddam Hussein is stronger now than ever, if not in numbers of tanks and weapons, certainly politically, in world public opinion among the non-Western nations and among all the Arab states. And he is very much a threat in the region. He is still a threat to Kuwait, a threat to Saudi Arabia. Look what happened recently when he was invited to go up into northern Iraq and to subdue a couple of the warring factions. One of them, of course, he was actually invited in by one of the warring factions of the Kurds that are inside the Iraqi border. And then we slammed some cruise missiles into southern Iraq and extended the no-fly zone. And, of course, it was something you could debate endlessly as to whether or not it was a wise move on the part of President Clinton or whether or not it was an opportunistic affair, which he simply leapt upon because of the way it would look and, of course, because of the impending elections. Be that as it may, just be reminded of the backdrop, the scenario, what led to all of this. Now, here we are with this uprising among the Palestinians in Jerusalem once again. And what caused it? Palestinian anger and hatred over the alleged desecration of their holy sites. It's always religion. The media, it seems, goes right over that. They scarcely ever look at the roots of the entire problem. the fact that Jerusalem is at once the capital of the three great monotheistic religions. When I say capital, I mean the place with some of its chief holy sites, whether nominal Christianity, whether Islam, or that is Buddhism, I should say Islamic fundamentalism, that is Mohammedanism, as they used to refer to it, or whether it is Judaism. So Judaism, Mohammedanism, or Islam, and nominal Christianity all look upon Jerusalem as a holy city with holy sites. In the case of the Christians, of course, they believe that it has all sorts of incredibly holy sites having to do with the ministry of Jesus Christ. And certainly, from my point of view, though God says in the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation, that city is today not called holy, but Sodom and Egypt, nevertheless, historically, archaeologically, biblically, it is a fascinating and a very interesting place. Golgotha, the Garden Tomb, and certainly the promontories and the mountains, if not the very streets, because everything has been changed and is at different levels and is not the same as it was when Jesus walked there. But excavations have gone down to the Herodian level, and there are excavations where there are floors with their mosaics and so on that were there during Jesus' day. And that is fascinating, and that is interesting. So all three of the great monotheistic religions look upon those areas as holy, having holy sites of great interest. And when one of these religions seems to be desecrating and treading underfoot or treating with contempt the holy sites of another one, they react not according to what their own religion preaches, which is with tolerance and patience and understanding and being willing to negotiate and being willing to forgive. No, they react with anger, with violence, and with warfare. So the entire upset over there was about the opening of that temple. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Now you know and I know that we could awaken tomorrow and we could hear that united Arab armies, combined attacks, are once again being launched against Israel on three different fronts. The Iraqis, or they could even be joined in some bizarre scenario by the Saudi Arabians, believe it or not, because those people believe alike. They think alike. They are the same kind of peoples. They have the same religion. They have the same language, written and spoken. There are certain little dialectic differences here and there, but they can understand one another. And the Arabs of Egypt, the largest, most populous Arab state, and the Arabs of Syria, and the Arabs of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, are brothers. They all know where they descended. They know that they go all the way back to Abraham, and they look upon Abraham, they look upon Moses as prophets, they even look upon Jesus Christ as being a prophet. But they have decided that Muhammad was the greatest prophet of all, and he is their Messiah, in a sense. They believe that he ascended to heaven, and so they worship Muhammad. But those people have a lot more than you think that unites them, and far more that unites them spiritually, linguistically, historically, and racially than they really do that divides them. And one thing that does unite them is their united desire to exterminate the Jews, to get rid of Israel, to simply get them out of there. Now, one artifice that has been suggested by a gentleman I know, and I have interviewed, I've been in his home. He is a leader among the Palestinian Arabs. He lives in the old city, just outside the walls of the old city. He lives in the Arab part of Jerusalem. And if he is not the godfather of a new Palestinian state, I do not know who is. His name is Faisal Husseini, and he is a top PLO official and Arafat's minister for Jerusalem affairs. I've been at his home, as I said. I've interviewed him there. He had in his wall a picture of some of the slain young Arabs when the original Intifada got started, when Gershon Salomon of the Temple of the Mount, or the Mount of the Temple Faithful, I believe it is Mount of the Temple Faithful, but whichever way it is, Gershon Salomon was the man who said that the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque had to be dynamited and simply bulldozed out of the way. We interviewed him on our television program. And that interview has been printed in our brochure entitled, Will a Temple Soon Be Built in Jerusalem? Which you can have if you want to call for it or write from it. It's free of charge and no price. And Gershon Salomon is one of these very radical Jewish gentleman who, like many other groups, wants to see a temple built in Jerusalem, wants to see a priesthood consecrated, wants to see the beginning of sacrificial offerings, wants to see priests wearing the vestments of the priesthood, a return to the Levitical priesthood in that sense as they see it and understand it today. And he is not alone. There are other organizations that want to do exactly the same thing. Now, Faisal Husseini had on his wall a picture of the young Arabs that were slain in the riots that followed when Gershon Salomon and his Temple Mount Faithful group walked up toward the Wailing Wall and on up beyond it, and they wanted to go right where they believe the corner of the old ancient temple used to be, and they wanted to lay a symbolic cornerstone. And that word got out, and thousands of young, very violent Arabs took to the streets and began throwing rocks, and the same thing occurred then, except perhaps a little bit worse, as has occurred recently. Eventually, the violence escalated to where Israeli troops opened fire, and quite a number of young Palestinians were slain. And there was a bloody picture of that on Faisal Husseini's wall. Now listen to what Faisal Husseini is planning to do. He believes that even though the Palestinians are scattered all over the West Bank, Hebron, Ramallah, East Jerusalem, other little enclaves up and down the length and breadth of the West Bank, where they've always been, and also clear over in Gaza, so that if you had a map of Palestinians and where they live and where they have a certain amount of joint control with the Israelis, the map of the West Bank, and that would have to include the Gaza Strip, would look like it had leopard spots, because they are just intermingled with, all over and among, Israeli settlements on the West Bank. Now here's what Faisal Husseini wants to do. He wants to suddenly declare Palestinian independence. He believes that countries in Africa and in Europe, and he also believes a lot of the big Arab powers, and he's probably right in that, would immediately recognize that declaration. Have you ever heard of the Declaration of Independence before? Have you ever studied how the United States ended up with Panama so that the Panama Canal could be built, and about the original Gran Colombia, and how we sent our battleships and our gunboats down there, and how we actually ensconced the first man that was to be over the new nation of Colombia and declared that we recognized it immediately upon its Declaration of Independence? Well, Faisal Husseini wants the Palestinians to declare independence. They believe that much of the Third World and also much of Western Europe, including Germany, would immediately recognize them. Now that would put the United States in a very, very delicate situation. It would give the very same impetus to the Palestinians that was given to Israel in 1948 by the United Nations, when they recognized the state of Israel. Once it was recognized as a state, if you remember your history, a massive war broke out. And if you remember, it was a very narrow thing indeed when they fought their way up that roadway to relieve the beleaguered inhabitants of the Jewish side of Jerusalem that were surrounded by Jordanian and other Arab troops and were going to be starved to death. And they were already very, very near that because they were running out of water and out of food. It's quite a story in history. But it was only when the United Nations recognized that the state of Israel existed that that massive war broke out in 1948. That was their war for independence. Now look what would happen if the Palestinian Authority declared independence. It would give them a certain amount of legitimacy if the bulk of the nations in the United Nations, the Third World, and especially if Europe joined in and said, "We recognize you." That would then mean that other countries would be free to send support, armed support, aircraft, tanks, soldiers, weapons, bombs. Husseini says Israel would only have two options if independence were declared. If it tried to reoccupy the West Bank militarily, Husseini said, there will be a fight and a crisis in the whole region. He means the entire Middle East. He means widened Middle Eastern war. And he says, as Israeli losses mount, and of course, the more people involved, the more Arabs involved, the more arms involved from other nations, the more those losses would mount, he said both domestic and foreign pressure to withdraw will grow. And if Israel imposes an economic blockade on the West Bank with all of its towns and villages, he said, we will announce a disaster area, and then we will start to have airplanes coming from Europe. Let me interject at this point that for literally decades, as I have looked at the biblical prophecies of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, I have seen that there are two major prophecies that bear upon this part of the world and that zero in upon Jerusalem. One is in Matthew 24:15, when you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place. Matthew inserts parenthetically, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. And if you read down, he says, let them that are on the housetop not come down to take anything out of their house. Don't let people in the field return to take any of their goods or clothing. Woe unto a woman that is nursing a child. Pray that your flight be not in the winter. But he goes on to say in that same context, when he says, let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains, he says, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. That is world war. That is great war. That's a time of trouble that is unparalleled, unprecedented, unduplicated in the history of mankind. He went on to say, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. And that's not talking about spiritual salvation, but physical survival. Except those days should be shortened, meaning be cut short by God's divine intervention, there should no flesh be saved alive. But for those elect's sake, he said, those days shall be shortened. The second part of that prophecy is in Luke's version of the very same Olivet prophecy in Luke 21 and verse 20. And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Two things. An abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. More on that in a little while. And Jerusalem surrounded with armies. Now, there is a prophecy in the 11th chapter of Daniel that bears very, very heavily upon this precise scenario. And that is the prophecy that the king of the north, as he is called, is going to come into the Middle East and is going to occupy Israel, and is also going to overthrow Egypt and other countries that are nearby. Notice the time setting of that prophecy in Daniel the 11th chapter in verse 40. And at the time of the end. Now Daniel's prophecy, beginning in the second chapter, that depicts the great image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, that actually means the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greco-Macedonian, and the Roman Empire with its many resurrections and revivals. And I can prove that to you in a few minutes. He says, this time setting is at the time of the end. If you keep reading, you will see in verse 1 of chapter 12, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even at that same time, and at thy time, at that time, thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. That's the resurrection. Michael standing up is the intervention of God. It says in Matthew 24:22, except those days be cut short. God will send Michael the archangel to cut those days short. At that time your people shall be delivered. Jesus said, when you see these things begin to happen or begin to come to pass, then lift up your heads, for you know your redemption, your deliverance, draws nigh. So it is talking about the time of the end. So verse 40 of Daniel 11, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Is that Mubarak of Egypt or his successor? I actually, at this moment, cannot tell you. Is it the Saudi Arabian ruler, the next one, because the ailing old king is probably not going to be around very many more years? I really do not know. Anciently, it was the king of Egypt, the Ptolemies, a lesser line of pharaohs of Egypt, that was the king of the south. The king of the north was the head over one of the governments that resulted from the carving up of Alexander's Greco-Macedonian Empire, the Seleucidae of Syria that were eventually swallowed up by the Roman Empire and later on, of course, by the Ottoman Turkish Empire. The king of the south will push at him. That language does not imply armed aggression. It doesn't imply an attack by a king of the south up into the soft underbelly of Europe or anywhere else. It implies something such as has happened in the past, like an Arab oil embargo. It implies a shoving match, a pushing match. It implies something that precipitates an immediate military response. But when you understand that if Arab countries were to unitedly choke off European oil, you've simply got to ask yourself, what would be the European response? Would they have a choice? How long could they last? Now, while you're thinking about that, let me interject to tell you that in World War II, in the very beginning of it, between Japan and the United States, prior to Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had only about 2.5 years reserves during peacetime of all of their vital resources, their raw materials that are necessary for a modern nation to survive. Tin, iron, rubber, oil, you name it. They had stockpiles. They had small areas of supply. But that was mostly bottled up by the so-called ABCD powers of the American, British, Chinese, and Dutch. Remember that during that time, the oil wells at Balikpapan and over there in Java and in Celebes and Sumatra and in Indonesia, the modern nation of Indonesia today, which is one of the fourth most populous nations on the face of the earth, were possessed by the Dutch. It was the Dutch East Indies. The British had colonies all over the area, at Hong Kong, and especially Singapore, with its great 18-inch cannon that pointed out the sea and guarded the Straits of Malacca. On a wartime footing, the Japanese would have only 1 year to survive as a nation, and their economy would completely collapse, and there would be millions out of work, and people would begin to starve to death. So from the Japanese point of view, once those powers, Britain and America, and Roosevelt, because he wanted them out of Indochina, imposed embargoes upon the Japanese, froze Japanese assets in U.S. banks, choked off the flow of tin, of rubber, of oil, and other vital strategic supplies to Japan. The way the Japanese looked at it, they had no choice. They had to try to interdict the American fleet at Pearl Harbor in order to move south. They didn't intend to occupy the United States. They couldn't have begun to have hoped to have done such a thing. They wanted to completely cripple the U.S. fleet to move south. Why? Because of oil, tin, rubber, because of the supplies that were vital to continue to fuel what really is a bicycle economy that produces and exports abroad but has virtually no raw materials of its own. Now back to my original question. Just think about it geopolitically. Think about it from the standpoint of the vital strategic interests of Europe, of Japan, of the United States, and of all the world concerning Middle Eastern oil. If a king of the south, back to Daniel 11, verse 40, which I believe is going to be a modern Arab leader that might put together something reminiscent of the old United Arab Republic, who might really have the combined armies at his disposal, and the wealth and the oil resources of more than just one nation. But if he were to push at, meaning cut off the flow of oil, just like OPEC did back in 1973 following the Yom Kippur War, how long would Europe be able to survive? How long would the Japanese be able to survive? How long would their economies keep going away the way they are today? How long would the people continue to live in prosperity? It says that the king of the south will push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. It's an immediate response. It's a violent, quick, lightning-like response. And you and I remember that Hitler was the one who invented what is called blitzkrieg, or lightning warfare. We'll come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, and that, of course, means armored vehicles, but today's armored vehicles are tanks and armored personnel carriers. And with horsemen, same comment. This is Old King James English language, and it's the prophetic language of Daniel from thousands of years ago. And with many ships, and of course that's applicable today. And he, this king of the north, this northern power, which was always north and a little west of Jerusalem, shall enter into the countries, plural, and shall overflow and pass over. Biblical prophecy uses that language like a river overflowing its banks and passing over the banks and flooding out across the landscape to involve war where armies, soldiers, simply ignore national borders and overflow those borders and flow into other nations around the area where the war is being fought. He shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land. That is a king of the north, coming with a lightning-like attack, swiftly, furiously, as a result of some kind of a provocation. The provocation in biblical language is he shall push at him. It doesn't seem to imply bombs or nuclear weapons or an armed or aggressive attack. It doesn't seem to imply occupying territory. It seems to imply exactly what is set up and waiting in the wings to happen right now. And that is that here are all of these countries down there sitting atop the vast majority of the world's oil reserves, 8 million barrels a day produced by Saudi Arabia alone. So it says, he shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and I believe that may well mean Iraq and Jordan, and the chief of the children of Ammon, and Ammon is the capital of Jordan, and I should also say that that means Turkey, and I think there is very great reason to believe that, not only historically from World War I and World War II, where the Turks were neutral, but also because of their political stance today. Edom is Esau, and Esau is Turkey. Moab and Ammon are the Hashemites, the Arab states, I believe, perhaps of both Iraq and Jordan. It says, he shall stretch forth his hands also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Does that not strongly imply that the king of the south is, in fact, the leader of Egypt? It says he is going to move into Palestine. Well, Palestine is right en route, but the land of Egypt will not escape. He is going to occupy Egypt, and he will have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. That's push, it should say Cush and Put in the Old Testament language. And that does not mean necessarily just the modern nations of Ethiopia and Sudan. It may also imply that he occupies all the way to Saudi Arabia, because it is talking about India and Bangladesh. So look at what you have here. You have a king of the south, obviously in the area of Egypt, but somewhere south of Palestine, that pushes at a king of the north, north and west of Jerusalem, and as a result of some kind of a provocation, this king of the north, that I believe is the beast power, and I'll show you why in a moment, is going to come like a whirlwind into Palestine, occupy Jerusalem, as well as the nation of Egypt, and many other countries. The only ones that escape are apparently Turkey, perhaps Iraq, and Jordan. Now, what does that imply are the nations that do not escape? That seems to say Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Republics, it seems to say Kuwait, it seems to say Saudi Arabia, and the Bible specifically says Egypt. So here is the response to some kind of a shoving match. And the king of the north comes in like a whirlwind and occupies the glorious land which is Palestine. It then says in verse 44, but tidings out of the east and out of the north. Now out of the east and north is where you go to Russia. Russia is east and north. And Russia today, of course, is many, many different republics. If you look at Turkey, and you think about this for just a minute, I'll take time out from my main theme here to just explain to you something that you ought to understand. If you look at a map of Turkey, and you understand how the Clinton administration really did stub its toe with regard to the no-fly zone over northern Iraq and the attacks that were launched against southern Iraq, and you probably saw, if you didn't, you missed it, but I happened to see it, of the deputy foreign minister of Turkey interviewed on CNN
who said they had not been asked for U.S. to use Turkish Air Force bases and U.S. Air Force bases that are in Turkey, because Turkey, for all of these many, many years, has been a part of the United Nations. But they weren't even asked to participate. But if they had, they probably would have said no, because Turkey has got to live in the neighborhood. The Turkish neighborhood is fraught with great potential problems. Immediately to the west is Greece, and Turkey and Greece are of different religions. Greece is Greek Orthodox, and Turkey is Islamic. And they have warred and fought and warred and fought ever since World War II, not only over European Turkey, but also over the island of Cyprus. Then here immediately to the north is Georgia, a major state now of the former Soviet Union, or in other words, Russia. Right next to them is Armenia and Azerbaijan. And you come a little further on to the east, and there is Iran. And a little to the south, and there is Iraq. Those are Turkish neighbors, together with Syria. That's where Turkey lives, surrounded by Greek Orthodox Greeks on the west, that are also a part of NATO. And Turkey is a part of NATO, but there is great hostility between them religiously. And then Russia to their north. Well, those people have got to live in the neighborhood. They've got to be beholden to some of the agreements that they have with these other states. There is a lot of trade that goes back and forth between Turkey and Iraq and Iran, as a matter of fact. And another thing, Turkey does not want hundreds of thousands of Kurdish refugees flowing across into their borders that represent a tremendous drain upon their tax structure for the Turkish government to try to take care of those desperate people, so they didn't want any kind of a war to break out down there among the Kurds either. It is amazing how short-sighted some modern governments can be. But when it says tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him, that is this king of the north who by this time has occupied Palestine, the major power to the east and the north of there is Russia. And it says, therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many, which means he attacks first. Intelligence says Russia is about to move. Intelligence says these northern and eastern powers, and maybe it even includes some of the powers all the way to China and to Japan, who knows, are going to intervene in the Middle East, are not going to sit still for this. So he attacks first. And it says, notice verse 45, he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people. Men have divided the book of Daniel into chapters. The original Hebrew did not. The story flow goes right on that when this beast power plants the palace of his tabernacle, or his headquarters, his military and his economic headquarters in Jerusalem, that he is going to furiously launch a great war toward the north and the east of Palestine. And a tremendous war is going to get going, which is going to eventually culminate in the Battle of Armageddon, which the Bible also portrays. And it says, then is when Michael stands up, and there is a time of trouble such as never was since the time there was a nation to that same time. And at thy, that time thy people shall be delivered, chapter 12 and verse 1 of the book of Daniel. Now look how all of that fits together with Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Jesus Christ led up to the time of the Great Tribulation by talking about religious martyrdom. He said in answer to his shocking statement to the disciples that the time would come when there would not be one stone left atop another in Jerusalem. They said, tell us, when shall these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? He said, take heed that no man deceive you, because there would come religious confusion and false Christs and false prophets. He then said, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, and I've detailed that in great detail in that recent booklet that we published that we have available if you haven't read it, entitled, The Great Tribulation, Is It About to Happen? You can have that by return mail, free of charge, if you simply dial 903-825-2525, or if you write to us, Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2525, over here in Tyler, Texas, and the zip code is 75710. So there are to be wars and rumors of wars. But he said, that isn't the end. Don't be troubled. The end is not yet. Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. and there shall be famines, and there are, and there shall be, and pestilences, that's virulent disease epidemics, and there are, and there shall be, and certainly the Ebola virus and the spread of AIDS are included in those terrible predictions of the time that we are now about to enter. And he said there will be earthquakes in diverse places, and we have unusual earthquake and volcanic activity around the earth today. These are the beginning of sorrows, and then what did he prophesy? Religious persecution, religious martyrdom, the martyrdom of saints. Remember that the seals of the book of Revelation in the sixth chapter are exactly in the same sequence of events as the predictions of Jesus Christ in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Bullinger's Companion Bible makes that clear, but the Bible itself makes it clear in internal evidence. The horsemen of the apocalypse are exactly in the same sequence of events from Revelation 6 leading into Revelation 7, which is the intervention of God with the heavenly signs and the sealing of the 144,000 and the great innumerable multitude, so that the fifth seal becomes obvious that it is religious martyrdom of saints. And Jesus said, verse 9 of Matthew 24, "Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake, and then shall many be offended." We seem to be entering a time where the indications are of that very spirit and attitude among many of God's people today, a spirit of being offended. He said, "And shall betray one another." And we're certainly in a time right now where people betray one another, where there are betrayals, where there isn't loyalty, and where there isn't camaraderie and friendship and tolerance and patience, and where there isn't forgiveness, but rather where there is hostility and offense and people taking offense, people extremely thin-skinned, people who will mount up in great wrath over the slightest little imagined slight of some kind, and they're supposed to be Christian. It says they will be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. I have said on the World Tomorrow broadcast for 25 years before all these many years that I've been doing the television programs under the aegis of the Church of God International, and I've said, in a sense, partially facetiously, but I mean it as well, don't get too close to some of these religious people because you can get yourself killed. Now, I mean that in the light of what it looks like in the Middle East, for example, and here in Jesus' own prophecies about impending religious martyrdom. Some people become fanatical about their religion. And isn't it strange how the very people that ought to be the most loving, the most caring, the most forgiving, the most compassionate, the most tolerant, are sometimes the most intolerant and the most hateful, who will rise up in great righteous, self-righteous indignation and wrath and actually want to kill someone they hate them so virulently? Isn't that amazing? It seems to be true. How sad it is when the very foundational part of the cornerstone of the religion of Jesus Christ, who is the chief cornerstone and is the head of His church, is forgive one another, compassion, forgiveness, goodness, meekness, gentleness, faith. The Bible says, why do you not rather take the wrong? Jesus Christ said, if they persecuted me, they will persecute you. His dying words were, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. That kind of a spirit is so rare. It is hardly seen, oftentimes, even among those who name the name of Christ and believe they are a part of the true church of God. Father, forgive them. Well, to go on. He says, after that time of religious martyrdom, he says, then is going to be the setting up of the abomination of desolation. And in Luke 21, then when you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies. I want you to notice now the prophecy all the way back in Daniel, the second chapter. This is a foundational prophecy that helps you understand Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. Daniel's second chapter is where Daniel interpreted the mysterious dream of Nebuchadnezzar. I won't read it all because you can read all about the dream and how Daniel was called in to interpret it and how he began telling Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of what he saw. He says, beginning in verse 36, "This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation therefore, or thereof, before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given unto thine hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. He saw a great image. Its head was of gold. Its breast and arms were of silver. Its belly and its thighs were of brass. The legs were of iron, and the feet part of iron and part of clay, like a gigantic Assyrian king standing in this flat valley, its head looming up to the heavens and the skies, a gigantic image. When Daniel said, "Thou art this head of gold," notice the next verse, verse 39, Daniel 2, "And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee." That shows that king and kingdom in this prophecy are synonymous. And another third kingdom of brass. Now, all of the Bible commentaries and the Bible history books and the Bible handbooks, like even little Halley's Bible handbook, know that down through history, this has been proven to be the ancient Babylonian Empire that was overthrown and superseded by the Persian Empire, which was then overthrown by the Greco-Macedonian Empire under Alexander the Great, which was then divided up into four kingdoms, which is also covered in the book of Daniel, but eventually became the Roman Empire, which was then to have many different resurrections down through history, including an end-time resurrection, as we shall shortly prove right here in the second chapter of the book of Daniel, at the time of the end, and is going to be the great world-ruling empire, a modern, nuclear-armed, space-age resurrection of the same old system in the same territory that used to be called the Holy Roman Empire, which was, in so many cases, a Germanic kingdom. It is going to be resurrected. There's going to be an end-time empire of 10 major nations. And I believe they will be the King of the North, the beast power, that will come into Palestine and occupy it and overthrow the Middle East and occupy it, and then get involved in a global war, a gigantic world war, with those northern and eastern powers, which probably includes Russia and perhaps other nations as well. Notice what it says. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. That is, after Babylon falls, there would come one, which is the Persian Empire. Another third kingdom of brass, that's the Greco-Macedonian Empire, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, that was the ancient Roman Empire. Forasmuch as iron breaketh in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas you saw the feet and toes, how many toes? 2 feet, divided where? East and west, divided half and half, 5 toes on each foot, 10 toes in all. He said, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, forasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. Now, miry clay is not a unifying agent. It is instead an agent which is going to cause the iron to fall apart. He says in verse 42, and as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken, it should read in the margin, weak. Partly strong and partly brittle or weak. Verse 43, and whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. That is a multiracial, multilingual, multinational conglomerate of 10 kings. Now that doesn't have to mean 10 political states. That can mean far more than 10, because if there are 10 kings, they can rule over several different ethnic groups in one nation. Look at modern Belgium with the Flemish and the Walloons. There are many other nations where you can look at several different racial groups that are under one government. So it says in verse 43, whereas you saw the iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Now, notice the all-important verse 44 and 45, and look at the time element. And in the days of these kings, the 10 kings, not the ancient head of gold and the chest of silver and the belly and thighs of brass and the legs of iron and clay, but in the days of the 10 toes, notice what it says, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Forasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that is a symbolic stone cut out of a huge, big, monolithic mountain, and it is obviously a symbol of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. In the original dream, Nebuchadnezzar saw this. Thou sawest, Daniel told him, reading in verse 34 of Daniel 2, till a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. It smote the image on its feet, on the 10 toes. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That is obvious that it refers to Jesus Christ of Nazareth, his second coming, the establishment of his kingdom. And what does he do when he comes? He fights against a 10-nation combine. Now, if you're at home, turn to and read the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. You ought to read the entire chapter. I won't have time to do that in this program. Here is the judgment of the great fallen woman that sits astride a beast. In verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And we'll see in just a moment what are those 10 horns. The woman, and that's a symbol of a great fallen false church, was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, the colors of harlotry. And what are the colors of one of the greatest churches you know? Decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, all kinds of jewelry, tremendous wealth, great affluence. And it says, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication, because she has concourse with states. She is a state. She has ambassadors. She receives ambassadages from other countries from around the world. She is a political entity as well as a spiritual entity. And it says in verse 5, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery. They make God into a mystery. They say you can't understand the Godhead. They make God into such a mystery that millions of people do not hear sermons. They merely hear chants. They merely hear a language, a foreign language, that they don't even understand. They see symbols like cups and all sorts of things that are done. They see priests making all kinds of signs and doing things with their hands. But they don't hear soul-stirring sermons. They don't study their own Bible. In many nations where that great church is extant and wields power, it is absolutely, you can be persecuted. And in some cases, I've actually heard, you can be put to death for even being found with a Bible. People are not allowed to read the Bible. They're not allowed to study the Bible. In many nations where that great church holds sway, the Bible is virtually unknown. It is called mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So she has daughters that came out of her protesting. The mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, and I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints. What is that? That is religious persecution and martyrdom, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great astonishment, as it should read, not the kind of admiration that means approval, but with great awe and great astonishment. Look now in verse 12 through 14 of Revelation, the 17th chapter. We don't need to wonder what are those 10 horns on this great beast, which is controlled, which is ridden by a great church organization. It says the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. How many toes were there on the great image that represents the entirety of Babylon the Great? so that when the toes were smashed, the entire system came down and became so much chaff that was carried away, and the stone that smote them, which is obviously a representation of Jesus Christ, became a great mountain, meaning the kingdom of God, the government of God, and filled the whole world. How many toes were there? 10. How many horns are there on this beast? 10. When is the beast extant, and when does the woman control and ride over the beast? At the time of the second coming of Christ. When were the 10 toes smashed? By the great stone that is cut out symbolically, by the arrival of Jesus Christ. In what condition does Jesus Christ, who sends his angel, Gabriel and Michael, both, Gabriel, who is to sound the great last trump, and Michael, the archangel for the people of Israel, who is to stand up for his people, what condition do they find the people of God in when that great event of God's deliverance of the heavenly signs and the day of the Lord, which is God's wrath poured out upon the beast power, culminated in by the seven last plagues and the second coming of Jesus Christ? What is the condition of God's people? They're in the midst of terrible religious martyrdom, persecution, fleeing for their lives. That's why Jesus Christ said, "Let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." Maybe God will protect a few here and there. We hope and pray He does. I hope and pray He protects my family and me and, of course, my grandchildren and you and your loved ones, your family and your grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Of course we do. But notice what God's Word specifically states. There are going to be those who will be persecuted and even martyred for the name and the sake of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. If all you had of the Bible were three verses of Revelation 17, verses 12 through 14, you would understand a great deal about biblical prophecy and about the future, and you would have a lot of clues about just how it might all work out. It says, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast." So the beast is a conglomeration of 10 nations. He is like a super dictator over 10 other dictators. These have one mind. That means one purpose, one policy. They are in agreement. "And shall give their power and strength unto the beast." What is the power and the strength of a king? It's the power of his economy, the power of his natural resources and raw materials. It is the power of his armed forces. It is the power of his army and his navy. And when they give their power, that means they coalesce their power, they share their power, they pool it together so that you have 10 armies pooled together into one multinational force. "They shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb." They actually attempt to fight Jesus Christ at His coming. Now do you see why the stone smites the 10 toes? The stone that is Jesus Christ, that is symbolically in Nebuchadnezzar's dream so many thousands of years ago, that represents the second coming of Jesus Christ, that smashes these 10 kings, and they are completely destroyed. It goes on to say, "These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb," obviously Christ, "shall overcome them. For He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with Him are called and chosen and faithful." That is exactly what is going to occur at the last moment before the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, there is to come what is called an abomination of desolation. And that abomination in history was Antiochus Epiphanes, who sacked and pillaged Jerusalem and set up a statue of Jupiter Olympus in the Holy of Holies. During the Roman occupation and the destruction of Jerusalem in 71 A.D., it was once again the desecration of the temple and the setting up of the Roman standards at the temple gate. It had to do with the sacrificing of swine in the Holy of Holies. It was a terrible desecration. Turn to 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, and look at what it says. "I know that there are people today who believe that when Jesus said, 'When you see the abomination of desolation, stand in the holy place,' they want to believe that is somehow the church. And then they'll decide to label which church they think it is. whichever church it is they're mad at, whichever church they don't like, whichever church it is with which they're, you know, engaged in competition. I do not believe that is true for an instant, because Jesus Christ of Nazareth spoke in the now, in the present tense. And all his disciples had to do was glance over his shoulder, or maybe turn their heads a little bit to the left or the right, and there was the holy place, right over there across the brook Kidron, right there on the very near, in the very near distance, the horizon right there, the city of Jerusalem, there was the temple. And Jesus Christ said, stand in the holy place. Now that did happen to that living generation. It happened in the lifetime of the Apostle John. John lived on for 20-some years after the destruction of Jerusalem. He was on the Isle of Patmos before he died, probably a very elderly man, up in his 90s. He lived to see it. And hundreds of thousands of Jews died, and many of them had remembered Jesus' warning and his witness, but that was merely a prior fulfillment. It was a typical fulfillment. It was not the end-time fulfillment, because the bulk of Matthew 24 has to do with the second coming of Christ, not the desecration of the temple or the destruction of Jerusalem that was to occur during that living generation. The Apostle Paul thought for much of his life, until he wrote the second letter to Timothy, that he was going to be alive at the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ. He said, verse 1 of chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians, now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit, because demonic spirits will try to do that, nor by word, that's by false preaching and writing, by false doctrine, nor by letter as from us. There were those even during that day who would stoop to such horrible and nefarious practices as literally signing Paul's name to letters to try to make it look like it came from him when it really didn't. He said, don't be troubled either by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter, as from us, that the day of Christ is at hand. Some people were beginning to say that it was. Paul was saying, no, there has to come something first. He said, let no man deceive you by any means. That means any manner, method, or means. For that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. And you can't fall away unless you have stood up. If you're crawling around on your hands and knees, you can't fall. This has to do with a falling away from the truth. It doesn't have to do with people who have never known the truth and are completely deceived and in various different churches, then going back to their great mother church. It has to do with an actual falling away from the truth, a falling away from God's true church, a falling away from the faith once delivered to the saints, a falling away from the fundamental doctrines and the truths of God's Word that God's church has learned over the decades. And he says that day will not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. This is someone who exalts himself, not someone who humbles himself, not someone who says, please forgive me because I have sinned and done wrong, not someone who cries out to God's people with all of his heart, no, but someone who is exalted, who is arrogant, who has all the trappings of power, and who opposes all that is called God, who actually blasphemously puts himself in the place of God and wants people to look to him instead of to God. How thankful I am that in the more than 18 and one half years of this ministry under the aegis of the Church of God International, I have said dozens if not hundreds of times, don't follow me, follow Jesus Christ. Don't look to me, look beyond me to Jesus Christ. If you're standing beside me, you've got a clear vision ahead. If you're behind me, I block the view. I said, don't follow any man, follow Jesus Christ. Now it goes on to say, so that he as God sits in the temple of God. Now wait just a minute. The Apostle Paul wrote those words in approximately 55 A.D. It could have been as early as 51 or 52. But that was about 20 years before the temple was to be destroyed. When Paul wrote those words, the temple still stood. So when the Apostle Paul said, the temple of God, he didn't mean something else. He meant the temple of God. The temple of God was there. He was in it from time to time. He would go to Jerusalem and he would go into the temple. He did not mean a church organization of today, and he didn't mean that people can look around with paranoia and wonder whether their own church leader in some little church, some little breakaway group, or some organization somewhere is the great man of sin. Look, this is the great false prophet that has existed, so far as its office is concerned, for generations and generations, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It is the same system that martyred saints way back during the very days just after the foundation of the early New Testament church. It is the very system that grew out of a great apostasy that began to take people's lives and to murderously burn people alive and to kill them by every manner, method, and means you can imagine in such things as the Spanish Inquisition. The great false prophet sits in that office. He is not the head of some small breakaway church organization. The Apostle Paul wrote this, and the temple still stood when he did. He says, he as God sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. How does he do that? He says, remember you not that when I was yet with you I told you these things, and now you know what withholds, that he might be revealed in his time, for the mystery of iniquity. And it is a mystery religion. They make it confusing. They make it into a mystery. Iniquity means lawlessness. They reject God's law. They preach a doctrine that allows people to reject God's law, to set aside God's law. The mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth, and that means restrains or prevents, will let or continue to hinder or restrain until he be taken out of the way. Two possible translations there. One is that the Apostle Paul himself would die. The other is the Greek phrase ginomai, that means until it become to be or become obvious for what it is. Because it goes on to say in verse 8, and then shall that wicked, and the margin says wicked one, that's the man of sin, be revealed, as it says in verse 3, then shall that wicked be revealed, the very same word used again, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Jesus Christ of Nazareth is going to personally put to death two great world leaders at the time of his second coming. And you know who they are. They are the beast and the false prophet. Now, how does this man, the false prophet, in the temple of God, sitting in the temple of God, showing that he is God, how does he get people to go along with that? How does he get people to believe that? How can he deceive people into thinking that he is actually Christ, already here? Because it says right here in verse 9, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders, he is able to produce fabulous miracles that people have no explanation for. And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that are perishing, as it should read in the present progressive or the Greek aorist tense, because they receive not the love of the truth. That's verse 10 of 2 Thessalonians 2. Now turn to Revelation, the 19th chapter, and notice the very first thing that Jesus Christ of Nazareth does when he stands upon this earth. It describes his second coming beginning in verse 11. John says, I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he does judge and make war. The description of his coming is then given. He is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We read in Revelation 17 that he is to destroy those 10 nations. And we saw that in Daniel, the second chapter, the stone, that is Jesus Christ, smashes the 10 toes. Now notice, in verse 19 of Revelation 19, and I saw the beast, and the kings of the earth, and their armies, gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse, and against his army. How and why would they do that? Because they are convinced that Christ is already on the earth. Because they are convinced that there is a Christ sitting in the temple of God. Does that not mean, or very strongly imply, what other words can you use, that a temple is yet to be built? If not a temple, will it not be at least a symbolic cornerstone, a temporary pavilion or structure of some sort? Would that satisfy the prophecy? The prophecy seems to imply a temple. It seems to imply the holy place inside the temple. It says that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is going to subdue and to conquer the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies that are gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army, and the beast was taken, that seized, arrested, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him. You see, the false prophet is not the leader of some little breakaway church organization. He is not the leader of some church group. He is in collusion with the super dictator that is over 10 nations. The two of them are cooperating. They're in complete harmony. And he really is the influence, the influential power that is behind the throne, the kingmaker, because it shows in Revelation 17 that the woman that represents the great false church over which the false prophet reigns is in control of, rides on, steers, directs, and controls the beast. Jesus Christ seizes, has taken, does it himself or his angels do it? The beast and the false prophet that wrought miracles before him. That's how he deceives the beast. And it says, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worship his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. Christ executes them on the spot by throwing them into Gehenna fire. And apparently that is going to be started right in the Valley of Hinnom, right outside of the city of Jerusalem. There will be a white-hot fire burning there, and Christ is going to throw those two wretched mass murderers, those two arch-criminals, into that lake of fire, and they're going to be screaming as they bounce against the rocks and fetch up down near the bottom of it. So the Bible says the beast and the false prophet are to be destroyed at the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now look at all of the scenarios that are possible that are now working toward setting up the very fulfillment of Daniel the 11th chapter, where a king of the south pushes at a king of the north who comes into Palestine at the behest of a great false religious leader, who might say, I'm going to return to the birthplace of the true church. Remember, he masquerades as Christ. Remember, he claims to be the true church. Remember that he has miraculous power. He will then come in there as the Prince of Peace. He will say the only way to spare the remaining Jewish population from complete extermination, because there is coming another Holocaust. There is coming the destruction of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. It's only going to be stopped by the intervention of a multinational force from the north and the west, which I believe is the beast power that is coming into Palestine. And the great false religious leader will be ensconced in the temple of God, showing that he is God. You need to watch for something that would occur in Israel, which would either galvanize the government itself or cause the Israeli government to allow the building of a Jewish temple. Does it require the destruction of the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque? Maybe, maybe not. There could be a temple built adjacent or right alongside. That's a possibility that has been discussed by some people. Watch for whether or not those Arab mosques are destroyed or whether or not a temple will be built immediately adjacent to them. Watch for the emergence of a powerful military and political leader among the Arab nations, maybe Egypt, that would emerge as the prophesied king of the south. Watch for, then, great major pronouncements by the head of the great universal church that is described as the great fallen woman in Revelation 17, which will be the setting up of abomination in the holy place, because if the holy place stands and a great world-known religious leader moves into it with the power to produce miracles, you are seeing with your own eyes the fulfillment of some of the major prophecies of Jesus Christ, and the Great Tribulation has begun. Watch for the emergence of the beast power, a political military dictator, an alliance in Europe, a 10-nation coalition, which will intervene in the Middle East. Now, there is so much more I wish I had time to tell you, but I've been talking here for an hour and a half, so I want you to get the current number to 20th Century Watch and read that very important article about whether or not Mideast peace has been shattered. Also get that booklet about the Great Tribulation. Is it about to happen? And also get our brochure on Is a Temple About to Be Built in Jerusalem? They're all free of charge, as you know, and no price whatsoever if you call us here at 903-825-2525, or if you write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2525 in Tyler, Texas, and the zip code is 75710. Well, I hope you have gotten a very great deal of good out of, and that you have been enlightened by what you have heard in this sermon tape, this Bible study tape, and I hope that you will continue to write in for more. Just let us know which subject in which you are interested. Let us know which booklets you would like to have or which sermon tapes you would like to hear, and we'll be happy to send them to you. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
This free audio presentation was made possible by the generous contributions of those who support this work of witness and warning. Send your letters and requests to Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office.